Okay, welcome to the Online Dating Insider Infrequent Podcast. Today we are talking to a startup in the social dating space called Likebrite. Hey guys.
Hey Dave, how are you?
Hey, how's it going, Dave?
Doing well. Why don't you introduce yourselves and tell everybody a little bit about Likebrite, and then we're going to start talking right about your experience at Techstars and social dating and a whole bunch of other things.
So my name is Nick Soman, and I am the CEO and co-founder of Likebrite. And my experience with Likebrite was that, you know, I grew up and tried a variety of things pertaining to dating, and not all of them worked really well. And fairly recently, I actually met the woman I'm going to marry, which I'm really excited about, through some female friends. And so I learned from experience how powerful it can be when, you know, women will say a good thing about a guy. And sort of by extension, how useful it is to be able to access your own social networks and meet and date friends of friends. And so Likebrite is kind of intended to bring that idea to life. And what really drove it home for me was talking to my female friends about what's out there now. There's a lot of stuff that's good. There's a lot of stuff that works fairly well. But a lot of them express some comfort in the idea of dating within their social network or dating people that their friends had sort of validated as trustworthy. So we commenced to build Likebrite, and that's me.
Well, first off, congratulations on that.
Thank you. It's good news. She's way out of my league, so I know it works.
All right. My name is Richard Luck, and I'm the technical guy behind Likebrite. Honestly, I'm pretty new to the company. I met Nick at a startup event here in Seattle just about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And, you know, to meet him in person and to hear him talk about his vision for Likebrite, you know, sold me immediately, and I knew I had to be a part of it. So I dumped everything else I was doing and jumped on board and couldn't be happier.
Great. So tell us a little bit about the Techstars experience, because there's a lot, you know, I've worked with literally hundreds of dating-oriented startups over the years, and everybody from, you know, starting a free dating site to a white label one to, here's $6 million, let's go spend it and see what happens. So having a group of mentors around, and Paul Graham and the sort of halo or aura of greatness with the groups coming out of Techstars and the mentorship that you get, how has that helped or affected your go-to-market strategy? And, you know, were they able to say things like prioritizing features and functionality or you know, get you to market faster, as opposed to sometimes when you're in startup mode, you can spend 6 months just sort of rolling things around, taking a look at it, as opposed to you got a couple of months, then you present, and then we take it from there?
So that's a great question. I couldn't be more bullish on the Techstars program. I know you've been involved in it, and the incubator space in general is really fantastic. Y Combinator, you mentioned Paul Graham, is great too. Techstars is wonderful. And the reason why, you know, these things are great for a company, which wasn't immediately apparent to me before signing up, you know, they'll give you a little bit of money. They'll trade you for equity. That's nice to have. You know, they bring you in and they give you a space to work, and that's nice to have too. But I think the things that are a differentiator are, you said you'd worked with a ton of dating startups, and usually, you know, being guilty of this myself, the dating startup starts when you have a couple glasses of wine with some friends and you say, God, this should be so easy. We should make it so easy using the internet, where there are millions and millions of people, to just meet people. And, you know, it sounds that simple. And that's why you see so many shots on goal in this space. And frankly, one of the true benefits of Techstars is it puts you in a room with, you know, dozens and dozens of very smart people who really don't have any incentive to, you know, to gloss it over for you. And they'll tell you, well, I wouldn't use that for this reason, or that idea sort of sucks for this reason, or, you know, the single gem that you've got in that, you know, big gnarly idea of yours is this part, and so you might want to double down on that. You just really get a type of focused attention and valuable advice that comes from experience that you might not get in the outside world. And then secondly, you know, there's a real signal-to-noise problem for startups, and just the fact that Techstars is a fantastic program validated by folks like David Cohen, David Tisch, Andy Sack, it really means that people will take your call, people will listen to you. The most prominent online dating blogger the world has ever known, you, is willing to have a conference call with us. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that Techstars helps you rise out of the noise.
Well, 2 points. First, thank you very much. And I think it's the other way around, because I love talking with startups, and you guys are the ones that really get my brain churning about new ideas and what's happening in the space, because there's a lot of decade-old growth in the industry, which is doing quite well, but there's a whole new set of companies coming into this space that, you know, sort of grew up on Facebook and with social tools and Twitter and blogging and whatnot, and realizing the importance of friends, where some of the old growth sites really have to stick to their knitting, you know, static profiles, better search and behavioral modeling, and taking it from there. And I also want to say I did confuse the Techstars and Y Combinator for a second, but to me that's a good thing, right? That means there's lots of incubators out there. My friend doesn't like to call them incubators because he says an incubator is for a sick baby. You want to call them an accelerator.
Accelerator.
Right? That's
I know
right.
Your friend.
There you go.
You probably do. So that's great that you have the support, and I do like what you're saying about you know, doubling down on certain ideas and the freedom to pivot. I mean, I know before, you know, Techstars and some other accelerators, before they have the graduating class, sometimes a week beforehand you can go under or go through a major pivot. You know, in this case, it seems to be more of a refinement, right, of focusing on one functionality over another. But there are companies like Zoosk, for example, that were doing completely different things before they got into the dating space. You know, social or dating was a feature of a pre-existing product that was getting a lot of attention, and they decided to pivot, double down on that, and that's what they went forward with, and to their you know, to their benefit for sure.
They're doing well. And David, you mentioned Zoosk, and I think there's a clue to something in there, in the fact that they aggregated a whole lot of people and then decided to spin out towards dating. Now, I've seen you mention that customer acquisition is what drives some people towards kind of the social dating sector. Can you talk a little bit more about that and where you see the opportunities and challenges?
Oh, nice spin on the tail right there.
you got me.
First off, I wrote a piece last week about Kismet, Long Live Social Dating, on my blog at onlinedatingpost.com. And I just wanted to read my general description of what I think social dating is, because I think a lot of people will be able to add some surface and some angles to that as well, too. It's just my take on it, and it's such a new thing. It doesn't even really have – somebody's got to go out and do the Wikipedia entry for that. So I said, social dating takes the best K-factor or viral growth know-how from Facebook, adds a dash of vouching for friends, a pinch of testimonials, and some basic technology to match each other up. It may lead to a friendship or a hookup, depending on the focus of the service. Profiles tend to be more dynamic, the crowd younger, and nobody pays for anything yet. As social dating evolves, this definition will no doubt be refined, but we have to start somewhere. And then I ask for comments if you have something to add. And people don't usually like to comment on my blog because they work for public companies. So that being said, I'd love to, and I know I read that quickly, but you know, that's my take on it. And it's not just Facebook. You know, it's social. You know, social exhaust is a phrase I love. So it's all the stuff that we throw off from everything from Instagram to Twitter and everything in between. But the focus is really on friends matching up friends. And you guys talk about vouching in your business model a little bit as well. And going back to Kismet as well, too, just to give them a quick shout out. You know, that was one of the sites that had $6 million. They built arguably a social dating site 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, they didn't focus on the right things. And at the time, you never really know what to focus on with 100% certainty. But I like to think that they had a lot of time to do this and it didn't quite work. So that doesn't, you know, what's old is new again, right? So a lot of the ideas that they came up with in terms of here are all your friends that you've added to the site. You can be a matchmaker for them. And also, you know, an old woman living somewhere in the woods in Idaho could be a matchmaker as well, too, which I think is really, you know, that idea of crowdsourcing the effort. So there's the heavy lifting that the Matches and the eHarmonies and the OkCupids and whatnot do, you know, through algorithms and behavioral modeling. And then there's, you guys know me well enough after a couple of Skype calls to mm-hmm. know the kind of woman that I'm into. So you could introduce me to the two women that you know that are like that and keep me away from the 150 women you know that are nothing like the type of person that I'd like to spend some time with.
Well, Dave, you raise an interesting point. I think 5 years from now, we're all going to look back at social dating and figure out why sites like Match and eHarmony thought that it was beneficial to bring total strangers together based upon some survey that they filled out. That's not how it works in the real world. In the real world, we meet people through our mutual connections. And I think to answer your point, that's what social dating is really all about, is leveraging those social connections that we already have in an online world and applying it to an offline situation.
I think that's right. And David, I would say one more thing, which is that, you know, the temptation of that idea of, oh, we'll just go through friends of friends, or the temptation of, we'll just grow really fast because it's on Facebook, so it'll go viral, right? You know, all of us have kind of had those hopes and had them dashed. And I think one of the things that's true in dating, and it's true in starting a dating company, is you got to get out there, but you also have to listen to feedback. And so, you know, we're launching early, kind of like, you know, when I went out on the town when I was 15 years old in jean shorts, and it took me a little time to figure out that I really wasn't getting anywhere. But I wouldn't have ever found that out if I hadn't been able to listen to, you know, my prospective partners or customers. And it sort of works the same way here. You have to be willing to take some egg on your face and say, you know, my zoot suit outfit really isn't working for people, but, you know, at least I got out there and tested it. And I think that's the name of the game. And instead of just thinking that, you know, you're going to go walk in the club as the new social dating startup and go viral and be real hot, you know, you need to listen and tweak and improve. And I'm really given heart by stories from outside of the space, like Pinterest, who, you know, I believe worked for months and years to hone their frictionless strategy towards, you know, acquiring customers and keeping people engaged on site. They really focused on A/B testing rather than monetization, and they were able to really succeed, and they're one of the hits of, you know, this early year. So you have to be willing to probably be free, like you've said in the past, to get up to that point where you're really providing something of value and really learn quickly as you're doing it.
What would you say is the number one or two thing that you've learned so far? So you guys are basically still in beta, right? Sort of a limited engagement release, as it were. And I know that you have some stuff on your, you know, your staging server that's different than what people are seeing live. You know, what have you learned so far, and what can people expect to see from Likebright in the next couple of months?
That's a great question. I'll take a shot at it, and then Richard, I'd love to hear what you think. Two things that we've learned, and this is me probably being more blunt than I will be in the future. It's easier to satisfy guys on dating sites than it is to satisfy women. You can build a feature that, you know, you as a guy might use and say, oh, this is really, really great. And women tend to, you know, they want to see a little bit more information, or they might be a bit pickier, as you could arguably say that they often are in the offline world as well. And so, you know, you can get yourself really excited by going and building something that your guy friends tell you, oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And, you know, for some relationships, and certainly we're, one of our goals in the next couple months, as you asked, is to be inclusive of all sexualities and all preferences. But for some relationships, if you just satisfy the guy and the girl isn't excited, you know, you really haven't built too much. So that's one piece. You really have to focus on what the women want. And then another one is that there's just this inherent tension between the opportunity provided by Facebook, such that, you know, you think, well, I can get out to all of these different people because there's 800 million people on this site and everybody's comfortable using it. But if you're not careful, you're going to scare people away. And so one of the things we're really focused on in Likebright right now is finding the right way to give people all of the anonymity and privacy that they want while giving them access to some of the communication channels that Facebook provides. And I think anybody who really wins in social dating is going to need to sort of answer that question. Is it social? Does that have to mean that it's always public, or can we give people the privacy that they desire to? Richard, that's what I see. Any other thoughts from your side?
Yeah, one of the things that's been very surprising to me in terms of how the different sexes are using the site is that for women, it seems to be more of a communal experience, which is really interesting to us. We find that women will group around the site, you know, in front of the computer in groups, and talk to each other about the guys that they're seeing on the site, where guys are sort of solo-minded in it. And that's a really that causes us to have to think in really unique ways about how we customize the user interface, how we customize that user experience. And I think hopefully that's going to be something that differentiates us, is because we're trying to sort of tease out how the different sexes want to interact with the site and apply that into our user experience.
Good stuff, guys. Along the lines of Facebook integration and working with those magical 800, 850 million people, you know, one of the first wave that I see of I'm just going to say dating in general, leveraging the power of Facebook, was reducing the friction of the sign-up process. And that would be, you know, click here to import your Facebook photos and your likes and an essay or two, or, you know, basically, you know, just copying over stuff from Facebook. But that was 2 or 3 years ago, and there's companies like Triangulate. They did that very well. But again, they spent a lot of time and a lot of money trying to get past that and never were really quite able to. So I think, you know, phase one of this was reducing friction in the sign-up process and getting that information out of Facebook and into the dating profile. Phase two now becomes, what are you going to do with that data? Right? I mean, this is why I have been talking about the social graph for years, and anybody who goes to developer.facebook.com and spends a couple of hours seeing what's possible and what Facebook is making available to developers and dating sites in terms of raw data, I think it's a treasure trove of people's personality, tastes, and preferences that isn't getting leveraged yet. So just saying that you like all these books is great, right? I mean, I could do that at the command line in about 10 minutes for a dating site right now. But it's having the cultural anthropologists or the psychologists or the, you know, the PhDs and the pointy hat people coming in and saying, well, what does that mean? You know, and the closest we're getting to that at the meta level, or the high level, I should say, now is stuff like Taste Buds and sites matching. You know, How About We is working with a food dating or a food site now. So I don't know if I want to date somebody just because she likes Twinkies like I do, or likes, you know, European pre-1970 death metal. But besides that, you know, what are the meaningful matches that can be made based on this additional metadata from Facebook? And now that they have, it's not just liking things, but it's buying things or disliking things. So they're creating tons and tons of verbs that you can apply to yourself. So I'm waiting to see what dating sites will do with that information and seeing if the efficiency of those the matching process actually improves. But I think that has to happen in parallel with what you guys are doing, which is your friends know you better than everybody else. They're that social mirror, and that's what Nick was starting to talk about before, that whole idea of, you know, is my breath good? You know, does my breath stink? Is my hair combed? Am I wearing a clean shirt, kind of a thing? But taking it a little bit farther. I mean, I watch people on dates at coffee shops all the time. It's a sport for me, and I actually live blog that on Facebook. And, you know, half the time you see the woman sort of glazing off into the distance, and the guy's just talking, or the other way around. You know, you want to be able to just walk up and say, hey, buddy, all you need to do is maybe shut up for a second. But, you know, creating those social cues from a third party like a dating site to help singles be better people and be better daters.
I think that's such an important part of it. And, you know, part of it has to do with the question you're trying to answer. And I know Sunil at Triangulate, who's spoken about this a little bit. I think they had a good thesis of pulling a lot of data in, because it's tempting to think, you know, the more you know about someone, the better a match you might think that they could be. But I think that there's a separate question that we might be trying to ask of, you know, what's the amount of information that'll get you comfortable potentially meeting up with someone and then really give you something to talk about? And I think one of the reasons that, as Richard mentioned, the offline world thrives on people meeting through mutual connections is that, you know, when I meet somebody through you, for example, you know, at least I can talk about you. If I go out, you know, and go out with a woman that you know, if I was single, which thankfully I'm not, then I would be able to talk about you, and we'd have something that we, you know, we really have in common. One thing that we have talked about doing with data that women have said would be interesting is, you know, if we could tell you the proportion of a guy's friends that are in relationships versus single, then you as a woman might have a sense of where that guy is in his dating life. And I think there are just a lot of things we can do with the data that are interesting and haven't been done like that.
That's great to hear. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I wanted to extend on what Nick was saying, and Nick touched on this, that, you know, having data is not enough. In fact, in many cases, we have too much data. And the challenge for us, and I think it is for these other dating sites, is not finding how people are similar, but finding how people are compatible. And that's a very different question to ask than a lot of these sites that have tons of data are currently asking. So we're trying to, like, again, tease out this information that's going to tell us how people are compatible based upon the information that they've self-provided, but also based upon the information that their network is providing about them.
That reminds me of something from years ago. We did a video conference with Howard Rheingold, and one of the things that he said that has stayed with me all this time was, pay attention to what you're paying attention to. And he was talking on a personal level, but at the data level or the metadata and the social exhaust, and you're right, being able to say that we have a million data points to match on is one thing, but let's find the 10 that are most meaningful. And I think that's really trial and error, you know. And again, the old growth dating sites really aren't able to, for the most part, move that quickly. Maybe they are on the back end with some of the algorithms that they're defining right now. But what I'm saying is almost on the front end in terms of what's touching the customer, in terms of this is the stuff that we want to pull over from your Twitter and Facebook account, and this is what we're going to match on. And guess what? If it doesn't work, we're going to throw it out next month and try something else and have the singles around basically for the ride. Right. Mm-hmm. And have them not freak out that you matched me with somebody and then you changed the algorithm and now we're no longer compatible, which is a fear that I think some people actually have.
Sure. And Dave, you raise an interesting point. Do you think that they're unable to make those changes as quickly as they are because of their size or because they really don't fundamentally care about their audience?
That's a very good point, and I have to say I think that's changed quite a bit. I haven't been out to visit eHarmony, but I spent a day with Match last year, and I got to spend a good hour with one of the guys who runs their algorithm talent. And they were talking about the fact that they create a new algorithm every month, and they pit that algorithm with the live algorithm, and they do a head-to-head battle, and whichever one performs better is the one that continues on. So I love that sort of Google index update in terms of it's not just set it and forget it like it was for so many years. So I was a bit disingenuous with that. You know, companies like Match are evolving these algorithms now, and it's great to see. For so many years, it didn't seem like they were. And when you're a public company and you're in a big battle for first place with companies like eHarmony, it's really, hey, we need to, you know, stick to our knitting and market the site. But now everybody's really moving forward, I think, with those algorithms. But again, you can't change the mix up too much because they're so large that they will alienate potentially millions of users if they do a violent change midstream. Whereas you guys have the ability to pivot on a dime, and you're not, that's I guess an assumption at this point, but you shouldn't risk losing so many people just because you try some new features. And I'm a big fan of innovation, right? Throw out what doesn't work and do that as quickly as possible and iterate. But that hasn't seemed to be the model that the dating industry has gone after. But you know what? You guys and a bunch of other companies are leading that charge now, and everybody else is going to have to stand up and take notice, because I can easily see a company like yours, you know, at least hopping into the top 25 if you get the right blend of PR and marketing and brand awareness and your big party at South by Southwest and all that kind of stuff. get your TechCrunch 50,000 users, and then you have that big chasm of, okay, we got a whole bunch of people. You know, do you just stick with, you know, some level of appropriateness or mediocrity, or do you really try to take it to the next level and say, we want everybody on the site to go out on a date, and we're going to keep going until we, you know, get to that point? And that may take 15 or 20 years, you know, in the future with the DNA testing and all that kind of stuff. I think matching is going to be a lot more different than just your behavior and what football team you like.
Well, you mentioned you like OkCupid, as do I. And I just really – I have a lot of admiration for Sam and his team. And I think, you know, that their outcome of being purchased by a Match is really interesting. That's something that can happen in the space, is you kind of – pioneer some innovation, and then they might either pick you up or copy it if it's good. How would you advise smaller startups to avoid being, frankly, cheap or free R&D to some of these bigger companies that are seeking innovation that works?
I think that's a great question. How about we being copied almost pixel perfect by match is the number one issue that I think most people in the industry have kept an eye on in the last year or so. The problem with the big companies, and it's not just Match, you know, it's any big technology company, right? They have so much money and such a strong legal team that they're just going to keep the startup running through legal costs until they run out of cash. You know, mm-hmm. That's an effective business model and position for them to take, and it's worked in the past. I don't see why they do it any differently. I think everybody's been a little too quick to jump on the fact that just because you want to go ice skating and I want to go ice skating means that we're a good match. But then again, I'm 43. I'm not in my early 20s anymore. And maybe that's what the young kids want to do these days, and that's enough. But for me, I just think there has to be more there. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you know, I say keep going. You know, OkCupid is a great tale of innovating on their own and then being acquired. Although I get a lot of email from people lately asking why certain OkCupid features seem to be falling off of the radar in the last year. Mm-hmm. And that's almost a whole different conversation. But, you know, it's careful what you wish for. Right, because I think a lot of people start to get upset when their functionality tends to disappear that they really found near and dear to the site. Mm-hmm. But to your point, it's really what can you do? I think you just keep swinging for the fences. Because guess what? Nobody's going to get anywhere near Match on a global reach in the next 5 years. I mean, shooting for the stars, really important. You know, being one of the top 100 dating sites is a good place to start. But, you know, five companies make the market, 25 matter, and everybody else can be making decent money but really don't move the needle too far on a month-to-month basis. So I say keep pushing forward because what's going to happen? It's going to get better for everybody, right? I'm misquoting it, but was it JFK, right? Rising tides raise all ships. And I'm saying it wrong, but it's that idea of instead of being completely opaque, you know, getting some transparency out there. And I hope that people are down at iDate and in Miami right now sharing what's working and not working for them so everybody can have a better dating site, which is going to grow the marketplace much more than it is right now. I mean, there's so much addressable market in the U.S. alone that isn't being touched that this idea of saying, you know, we're the only company that's going to have this angle, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, look how many copies of Pinterest there are. Look how many Facebook clones there are, so on and so forth. So exactly. Bottom line is, I say keep going. If a big company wants to copy you, they're going to do it anyway. And they make a little bit more money off of that. But guess what? If they do it and make money off of it, you're going to do it and make a lot of money off of it. So it really depends on how you look at it in terms of half full or half empty glass.
And you mentioned that addressable market, and I really think that's so important. I mean, there's a large, large market of folks that are already using these sites that might be reachable, but there's these other folks, and you really think, you know, statistics that I've heard, it's a low percentage. It's certainly less than 10, and I've heard less than 5% of American singles have paid for online dating before. And I think when you look at how to get to those people, like so many things in our lives, one of the keys to that is social proof. So, you know, finding that right balance where people feel like their privacy is being respected, but they can see that their friends are on and enjoying a new product, that's going to work in dating as it potentially could work in other places too. If people are excited about this stuff and they're sharing it, and the companies are, as you said, really listening and learning and taking a long view to delighting customers rather than, you know, seeking immediate and in some cases kind of tacky monetization opportunities, ahem, badoo. And so I think, you know, folks that are really focused that way will make customers happy, and that's the only place good things come from.
Good stuff, guys. Hey, I tell you what, we've gone pretty long today. I appreciate having you guys call in like this. One more question, and Richard, if I just cut you off, I'm sorry. Feel free to finish up. Predictions for dating in 2012. What's going to happen with the industry? What's going to happen with you guys?
Take it, Nick.
Well, it's a great question. I want to hear a little bit about what you think first on that, honestly, and give me a minute to collect my thoughts.
Sounds good. Basically, I think in a lot of ways it's more of the same. Mobile dating is taking off. We had that great Eamore dating startup event in last summer in New York, And actually, Sam Yagan from OKCupid came down to a keynote, which was great. But it was nice to see a lot of younger kids right out of B-school talking about the role of social dating, mobile dating, not being so algorithm-driven, spending a lot more time on location-based services and geofencing in terms of who are the people that match my general dating criteria within 5 miles and put me in touch with them, so on and so forth. The group dating stuff and Igniter, that continues to blow up. And, you know, they're changing their name and they're international now. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of people that figure out when you throw your dating site up against the wall, it doesn't just mean that Europe or the United States are the demographics of people that are going to take to your particular spin on it. As always, continued roll up in the space, right? Match is just going to keep buying the right companies. That's what they do now. They grow certain ways, and there is some organic growth, and I argue with them about that all the time. But, you know, publicly, what they're showing us through their financial reports is they grow through acquisition. And that's great, too. And they're going to continue. You know, there's a lot, 60 million people in the United States every month don't do online dating that are single. So that, you know, how do you get to that? You know, then we play the fun game of who are they going to buy next? And then you have, you know, in Europe, you have Cupid.com, right? In the last 2 years, that company has really, you know, grown up and put their big boy pants on. So they're doing some acquisitions now and some great white label stuff, and they're socking away some cash in the bank. So, and finally, it's really the raw startups like you guys coming out of the incubators. There's a couple of guys, you know, that don't have two proverbial nickels to rub together that I'm trying to help out right now and get some funding, because they do have some outstanding ideas that I haven't heard before. And I always like to say I've heard it all, right? It's just another spin on a five-year-old idea. But I think people, you know, the stigma has finally worn off enough, and a lot of that is thanks to social networks, right? So people are a lot more apt to jump on a dating site or a mobile app than they were in the past. And again, that's a big win all around. So here's for a $2 million revenue stream, at least in the United States and Europe in 2012.
Well, here's one more thought that's just piggybacking on what you said, because you know, I agree with your assessment. You're really an informed guy about this space, and it's a pleasure to talk to you about it. I would make one bold prediction. I think in 2012, we're going to see more blurred lines. And what I mean by that is we're already seeing some mobile apps that are springing up where, you know, people are asking themselves, you know, is this a dating site, or is dating a use case of this thing that I'm using? Tingle is out there now. You know, Grindr has kind of pioneered this in the gay community, and, you know, Grindr is pretty romance or love focused. But I think we're going to see, especially in the mobile space, but really throughout, you know, a little bit more blurring of the lines. And my friend Paul Davison just released an app called Highlight that, you know, lets you walk around, and if you walk near somebody that you have a friend in common with, it'll just send you a push notification. And, you know, I think we're going to have some mass adoption of applications that certainly have a dating angle. And people will, in a way, be, you know, expressing some interest in this space, but not having to necessarily self-identify themselves as, you know, using something that's expressly for dating. And one outcome of that is also that I believe that there'll be a clearer role in 2012 for the non-single person on, you know, at least some of these sites. I think right now, you know, we have a lot of interest when we talk to folks about social dating and in this matchmaking angle, and it's tough to do. You know, as you've brought it up, it often adds another element of uncertainty to the mix of getting the message out. But there really is a hunger for, you know, folks that would like to be involved and might not be single themselves. And I think through the combination of this blurred lines and social dating, you know, we'll see more of a role for those folks on the horizon in 2012. And, you know, I'm really hoping that Likebright is positioned to capitalize on both of those trends.
Richard, how about you?
I'm going to echo Nick's sentiments in terms of the industry. I would just say, in terms of Likebright specifically, you know, we're going to stay heads down and focused on satisfying our customers' desires and needs for the website. In fact, I wanted to let you know that the Meet functionality that you were looking at on our staging server is now live on likebright.com. So please feel free to check it out. Give us your feedback. We're just going to stay heads down from a technology perspective and continue to deliver in 2012.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks so much for your time. That was Nick Soman and Richard Luck from Likebright.
Thanks, Dave. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Dave.